Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Love Strategies. I'm Nina Atwood, and my goal is to take you on an inspiring journey of self-discovery and relationship recovery. I'm the host of the show, but this is really all about you, and it's for you, the single woman who wants to date smart and find the love of her life. On this show, casual sex is dumb, being choosy is smart, and the prize is a healthy, loving relationship that lasts. So call in, share your dating and relationship stories, ask the questions that keep you awake at night, and get coaching. The number to call in is 347-308-8511. That's 347-308-8511. Now, stay tuned for Love Strategies.
Well, good morning, everybody. You're listening to Love Strategies. I'm Nina Atwood, your host. And if you're joining us for the first time, well, welcome to the show. And if you've listened before, I'm really glad to have you back. So this show is all about this crazy thing that we call love. And today we're going to talk about some of the interesting science behind why do we choose the people that we do, and why do we do the things that we do all in the name of love. So we're going to talk about politics and love. You think, okay, what does politics have to do with love? We're going to find out today. We're also going to talk about divorce and remarriage and what you can do to maximize your odds of success if you're marrying for the second time around. You need to know this information. If you are a divorced person and you want it to work the second time, you need to know how to navigate those waters, because it is not as simple as you might think. And also in this show, I'm going to give you the lowdown on long-distance relationships. And there are situations in which they work and situations in which they do not. And I'm going to describe to you what those things are and then what you can do to increase the odds that you can actually make it in the long run with a long-distance relationship. So there's a new study that just came out in the Journal of Politics, an unlikely place for something about love, but here's what happened. They did a study and they found that people place more importance on finding a mate who is a kindred spirit with regard to politics, religion, and social activity or social belief than they do on hooking up with someone who's maybe similar to you in terms of physique or personality, that kind of thing. So this really caught my attention because as a psychotherapist and someone who's been studying social issues, why people do the things that they do over the years, what I was always taught or what I've always learned in the past is that people tend to choose their partners based on similarities of looks, you know, how you look, how attractive you are, at least if you're, you know, that's a hard thing to measure. But if you think about beautiful people versus people that are maybe not so beautiful, then all the studies in the past have shown that people tend to pick, beautiful people pick beautiful people, physically fit people pick physically fit people, and people who enjoy their pizza and KFC tend to pick people who enjoy their pizza and KFC. I mean, that's just kind of how we're wired, is we tend to pick people who are like us or very similar to us in terms of body and fitness and physical beauty. All right, so that's not a huge shock, you know, because you can see that played out in the world. And then people, it's always also been believed in the past that you tend to pick someone with a similar personality, you know, more outgoing people pick more outgoing people. Well, that really doesn't turn out to be terribly true. It turns out that people tend to pick people who have complementary personality traits. So the more outgoing person actually tends to choose someone who's a little less outgoing, and they kind of balance each other. It tends to work well that way. But the big surprise about this study is that people choose people who are of similar beliefs about social issues, religion, and politics. But here's the interesting thing about it, that we tend to pick people that are like us in those regards without ever talking about it. That's right. The study showed that, and they, by the way, this study was from a large online dating community, and the way that they did the study was they looked at how people selected who it was that they wanted to go out with. And what they found is that people were selecting people that were like themselves. If you're conservative, you tended to select someone conservative. If you're liberal, you tended to select someone who's liberal. But the interesting thing is that they were doing it without necessarily talking about it. They weren't really having those kinds of email exchanges and chats and talks. What are your beliefs? It was more like an instinctual thing, that we seem to be kind of wired in a way that we automatically gravitate toward those who share our beliefs when it comes to politics, religion, and social issues. So that I found fascinating, that because I would have thought, as a relationship educator for so many years, that the only way people would have done that would have been through conversation and asking lots of questions. But what the study shows, not so much. We just kind of instinctually know who it is that shares our beliefs. Isn't that fascinating? So it makes sense to me, because here's how we are wired. Our brains are constantly churning away in the background in an unconscious way, working on two things, two primary things, the two drivers of everything that people do as human beings. And those two things are connection and safety. Connection is vital to our well-being. We are wired to be tribal. That's how we survive for thousands of years, is by banding together into tribes and groups. So deep down, even if you think that you're some kind of an individualist and some kind of a anti-establishment or anti-social person, or you think that you don't need other people, or whatever it is that you think, the truth is, deep down, we are all wired to connect. We need to feel like we belong somewhere. And there are people who don't feel like they belong very much in their personal lives. They work all the time, put all their energy into their careers, but I promise you, they get a sense of connection with the people that they meet at work and that they interact with at work. So we're wired for connection. We're always working on it, always trying to figure out how to be like someone. We have to be, because we have to belong. Even if the place where you feel the most belonging is with a bunch of other people who don't think they need to belong, you're still belonging. You're belonging to the other people who don't need it. I know I'm getting really down a track here that might be confusing, but that's what we're working on, is that connection factor. So safety is the other thing that we work on continuously as human beings in the background in our mind. How to be emotionally safe is what we work on. We try to figure out how to feel safe. Now, thousands of years ago, safety meant physical safety. But in today's world, because we don't really work so much on physical safety, at least those of us who live in the modern world don't, so what we're working on constantly in this world is emotional and psychological safety. That's what we're looking for. Well, what better way to feel safe than to be with people who are like-minded, folks who share your basic beliefs? Because if you're around someone who does not share your beliefs, who feels very differently than you do, especially about something that's a hotbed of discussion like politics, well, if you're around someone who believes completely different than you do and they start challenging you, you can't help it. Emotionally, you don't feel so safe with that person. Emotionally, you feel this reaction. You feel triggered because you don't feel safe. You're going to be criticized. You're going to be made wrong somehow. So what we tend to do is be around people who share our beliefs so that we can feel safer. So that's what we're doing. And it seems that the same thing is happening in dating. We want to be with people that we feel safe with, and what feels safe is to date someone with the same basic religious and political beliefs. So here we are, we're picking all this up subliminally, and we instinctively know who shares our philosophies and who does not. Isn't that fascinating? So when you are out there in the dating world, you can definitely ask people questions and try to find out what their beliefs are. But I think more importantly, if you're paying attention, you will feel it. You will feel it on a deep down level if you're with someone who connects with you around those things. And the interesting thing, and I think the challenge would be, if you're someone who says, but I met someone who I am just crazy about, but I can tell they don't really share the same beliefs that I have. Not sure we're on the same page about religion. Not sure we're on the same page about politics. How is that going to work? I would say it's not that it can't work, but it will be challenging. And how you could make it work, I think, would be that you would have to have a lot of tolerance for having differences in beliefs. You would have to make it a point not to be challenging in a way that makes it personal, like there's something wrong with you if you feel differently than me. I think you would have to have a certain lighthearted touch about it when you have those conversations. I think you would have to keep it on the lighter side. Almost, you would have to laugh at yourself. If you were the conservative, you'd have to laugh at yourself. If you were the liberal, you'd have to laugh at yourself. You would not be able to get away with laughing at your partner. And you would absolutely never, ever, ever be able to get away with contempt. Because contempt is a killer in relationships. It will absolutely destroy your ability to be connected to your partner, to love and be loved by them. So you could never listen to your partner's differing beliefs and roll your eyes. That's right. Eye rolling is the biggest sign of contempt, and it is picked up on a subliminal level by the person that you're rolling your eyes at. And how they feel on a deep down level, even though they may not be consciously aware of it and may not acknowledge it, but how they feel is that they've been shot through the heart. And it doesn't matter what the issue is, whether it's differences in religious or political beliefs, or whether it is differences in how you load the dishwasher. You can't afford to be contemptuous in a relationship. Anybody who's listening to this, if you've ever had someone that you were very close to and they were rolling your eyes at you as you expressed yourself, you know what I'm talking about. You know how that feels. And I'm not talking about the kind of eye rolling that, you know, done in a lighthearted, funny spirit, like, oh boy, here we go. Not the kind that's done in a tone of humor and laughter together. And, you know, you really teasing each other in a loving way. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the kind of eye rolling where you are genuinely conveying the message that what that other person has said or done is just ridiculous, and that feels like an attack. It feels like an emotional assault to the other person. So, can't do that. All right, so I've got some more information for you about relationships and how they work. Here's another surprise that comes out of the latest census information. So for years, I've told my clients that second marriages are more likely to fail than first marriages, but less likely to fail than third marriages. But is that true? Is marriage better the second time around? Do we have a greater chance of success or a less of? Are we really trying to do something that's going to be harder? Well, here's what the latest census data tells us. And the background for this is that if you look at just purely the length of marriages, how long people are married when they're married for the second time, then you would see that second marriages are shorter. They have, if you average all the second marriages over a period of time and how long they lasted, that average number comes out to 14 and a half years, whereas if you average together all the first marriages and how long they lasted, you get 20.8 years for first marriages. That's according to the Census Bureau. But the reason for that, from the Bureau anyway, is that second marriages tend to begin later in life, and they're more likely to end when a spouse dies. So they're only measuring the length of the relationship or the length of the marriage. They're not measuring how those relationships ended, and they're not putting them in separate buckets. But if you do that, if you take just the bucket of divorce and you compare first and second marriages, only those that ended in divorce, not in death, then it turns out that the length of marriage is about the same, which is now 8 years. That's the average length of both first and second marriages that ended in divorce. That's according to the Census Report Marital Events of Americans, which was done in 2009 based on data collected in 2008. Isn't that interesting? So what that tells us is that people who remarry are really working hard to keep those marriages together. It's perhaps not the completely daunting task that we once thought it was, that people are able to succeed at roughly the same rate that couples are succeeding at first marriages. So there's some good news in there. And the good news is that you can go into a second marriage with a good deal of optimism that you should be able to make it at least as well as first marriages. However, most people who are remarrying are looking to do better. And I think that is the other issue here. So here's some more good news coming out of the census. Like so many others in this field, I have always reported that the divorce rate for first marriages is right around 50%, meaning half of all people who were married over a period of time got divorced, and that 50% rate was holding steady. It's not really getting worse. It's not getting better. But the divorce rate peaked around 1980 and is now at its lowest level since the 1970s, according to the Census Bureau. So in 2009, I'll go through these numbers real quickly, and then I'll tell you what it means, but 9.2 out of every 1,000 men age 15 plus and 9.7 out of every 1,000 women divorced in the past 12 months. Well, the number really doesn't add up to that 50% rate anymore. When they last looked at it in 1996 and estimated that some 50% of first marriages end in divorce, that number was based on numerical modeling, which is not the same thing as basing it on survey data. It didn't really address the question of second marriages, but now they believe the divorce rate for first marriages is more like 40%. So that's good news. That says that we have actually improved in the last few years, that somehow we are managing to learn a little bit about marriage and divorce, that we are perhaps working harder at keeping it together rather than running out the door. And that is good news, and I think that is something we definitely want to see more of, being more thoughtful about divorce, really not having the issues that you have with your husband or wife be so overwhelming that you can only imagine just escaping it, but rather that you could see yourselves working it out. I think that's good news for all of us. So now I want to get back to second marriages, and I want to talk to you about that. What is it when you do try to get married, or you do get married for the second time around, and you're trying to make that relationship work? What are the things that help you make it work versus the things that are probably going to get in your way? So we're going to take a break, and I'll come back and talk to you about that.
Hi, I'm Nina Atwood. Does this sound familiar to you? You start a new relationship full of hope that maybe this time he's the one. But weeks, months, or even years later, you realize that although the name and face have changed, the story is the same. He's all wrong for you, and now you have to continue suffering or start all over. Well, you don't have to keep repeating the same old patterns. If you want to raise your relationship game and put yourself on a whole new course for a happy, healthy, lasting love, get Temptations of the Single Girl, the 10 Dating Traps You Must Avoid. This is a self-help book like no other. It's a parable, an easy, fast story you can read in 2 to 3 hours. The fact that it's a story and not just dry, boring data means you'll retain the lessons learned far longer. And the more you retain, the greater the changes you'll be able to make in your life. That's why I wrote it this way, to make it easy for you to get what you need to permanently alter your love life for the better. You can get the book by clicking on the book cover right from the show page, or you can go to singlescoach.com, find the tab for books and tapes, then click on Singles Coach A Store. Temptations of the Single Girl is available through Amazon.com and as a Kindle book. And now back to more love strategies.
We're back to Love Strategies. I'm Nina Atwood, your host. And today we're talking about marriage and divorce and how you can maximize your odds, particularly in second marriages. So let's start out with that question. What can you do to maximize your odds of success the second time around? Because I know that a lot of you who listen to this show have been divorced, and that is what you are facing. Well, let's acknowledge, first of all, that the stakes are very high in second marriages. Often there are children involved, and children can be impacted far more than their parents realize, both in the process of divorcing from the first marriage, in the process of being single and dating and looking for a new partner, and in the process of choosing that new partner and bringing that person into your children's lives. Children are affected far more than we really want to acknowledge or realize. But if you've ever had your heart broken by a divorce, then you know what I mean on a personal level. You have more vulnerability the second time around. When you've been hurt, deeply hurt, and yet you still have that hope for that wonderful relationship that is going to make up for the past, you want it more than ever. You want that basic, fundamental thing in life that we're supposed to be able to attain, which is a lifelong love, a good relationship. Well, I've been there. I know exactly how that feels myself coming out of a divorce. And so there is that combination of this deep desire to have a relationship in the future that will be successful, but at the same time, just these deeply held feelings of vulnerability, the fear that I will get hurt again. I remember coming out of my divorce just feeling terrified that somehow I would delude myself again and marry someone who really didn't love me the way that I loved him, and that I would just get this complete bombshell down the road like I did in my divorce, and that I would find out I was married to the wrong person again and someone who was not devoted to me, and that I would get my heart ripped out again. So walking around with that kind of a fragile feeling, I knew was not going to be productive. So I had to figure out how to feel less fragile, but at the same time, not give up my basic vulnerability, which is being open and being available, emotionally available for a relationship. Because obviously, if we make a decision out of pain that we are going to barricade our hearts, well then, you know, guess what? If you're blocking out pain, you're also blocking out love. You just can't receive it from somebody else. So the success of getting married again, how you create a success, depends an awful lot on how well you deal with your divorce, on how well each person coming into that second marriage, if they're both coming from a divorce, then both of them have to have dealt very well with their divorce. What does that mean? Well, I've always believed in earning your way out of a marriage, which means that you work very, very hard to communicate fully to your spouse about your grievances, and that you leave no stone unturned in communicating these are the issues that we are having that are impacting me in a very negative way. These are the things that I stay awake about at night. These are the things that I feel pain about. These are the things that are not working for me. And that communication piece is so vital to working your way out of a marriage, and most people don't do it. What most people do is take their grievances and store them away. They put them in an invisible file folder called What's Wrong with My Spouse. And they keep that file folder nearby, and they add something new to it every day. And every time they add something new to it and it gets bigger, that drives them one step closer to making the decision to exit the marriage. And then one day, they look down at that file folder full of grievances, packed to the hilt with it. It's now a foot wide. They look at it and go, that's too much. That's too much. I've had enough. I can't put one more thing in that file. I just have to get out. And then they go and drop the bomb on the spouse. I'm leaving. Or I've met someone new. So, and that is not working your way out of the marriage. You haven't taken responsibility. You haven't communicated fully. So what I believe works far better, if you're going to go forward and really have a good life, is that you are communicating fully along the way while you are still in the marriage. And when you do that and you take responsibility for your role in the problem, you know, because it's never, ever, 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 ever a one-way street. It's always a two-way street. There's always some way. I may not be guilty for something that my spouse does, but I am responsible for dealing with it. I am responsible for communicating fully. I'm responsible for being as compassionate as I can be. I'm also responsible for being straight as I can be and really saying this is how it is. I'm responsible for setting my own boundaries. I'm responsible for taking care of myself. There's so many responsibilities that feed into marriage. And so people who take that responsibility and who communicate fully and then give lots of fair warning that you are considering divorce, those are the people who tend to do the best in a remarriage situation. That is what works. That is what earns your way out, is that when you start thinking about divorce, it's not the day before you packed your bag that you communicate it. When you start thinking about divorce, you communicate it at that. Now, I don't mean in the middle of a fight. You're mad, you're triggered, you're really upset. I'll just get a divorce. Or why don't we just get a divorce? I'm not talking about that kind of thing, the childish things that we do sometimes in the middle of a highly triggering argument or fight. I'm talking about in a thoughtful moment that you're actually sitting and reflecting about your marriage and you're beginning to think, I don't think this is the right relationship for me. I thought it was, but I've made a big mistake. I've married the wrong person and I really need to figure out how to get out of this. That is the day that you tell that person, you know, today I found myself really considering divorce, and I was shocked by that, and I'm saddened by that, and I don't want that to be where we end up, but that is what is going through my head, and that's telling me that I'm losing hope that we're going to work out our problem. And then that becomes a catalyst to getting help, because if you're not able to work it out yourself, you must get help, and counseling really does make a difference. If you get a really good therapist, a really good marriage and family therapist, it really can make a difference in your relationship. So that is how you earn your way out. And if you do that, guess what? You're going to have a really good shot at achieving these kinds of outcomes in your life. And all of these things add up to a divorce that is far less damaging. And one of those is that you can walk away and remain on cordial speaking terms. Well, if you share children, I can't think of anything more important than you being able to be on cordial speaking terms with your ex-spouse. So that is one of those things that you can get out of earning your way out. And then the other thing is that if you realize that you contributed to the failure of the marriage, you weren't the perfect person, that there were mistakes that you made, maybe you did the best you could, but you certainly made a lot of mistakes. If you have that humble realization that you contributed, then you are not going to carry forward a ton of resentment against your partner. And that resentment is, of course, one of the toxic elements that keeps us from going forward and making better choices in the future and taking good care of our children. So you want to keep that resentment down by acknowledging your part in it. Okay, now let's jump down the road. So you've earned your way out, hopefully, and now you're single and you're trying to make a good decision the second time around. Here are some things that really contribute to you being able to do this in a smart way and end up in a much better relationship the second time around, actually have a shot at staying married to that person. So one of the things that you should do is wait for a significant period of time before you date. And I'm talking about months, if possible. And during that time, you focus on getting a better sense of who you are and what you want in a relationship. It's kind of a recovery. It's an extended recovery period. And the second thing is to make a resolution to yourself not to get married while you're still feeling very lonely or still in a lot of grief, because getting married, remarried to stave off loneliness does not work. And you're also not going to remarry just to make up for all the pain of your first marriage. You know, that syndrome of, well, this person is somehow going to make up for me all the things that went wrong in that first marriage. That's not how it works. That person can't do that for you. So you're going to give yourself a good period of time to recover from your divorce so that you are no longer lonely, so that you've actually rebuilt your life, you actually have a good life, and you're doing things that matter to you, whether it's parenting your children from that first marriage, your job, your career, your extended family and friends, your hobbies, your participation in charities or giving back, whatever the things are, your church, your synagogue, whatever it is, you've rebuilt your life and you have a good life. You are coming from a good place in life. You are healthy emotionally, physically, spiritually, mentally. When I say healthy, I don't mean perfect. I am not talking about perfection. All you perfectionists out there who think you've got to achieve some lofty goal of being absolutely perfect before you can date, no, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about healthy. There's balance in your life. You may have your bad days, but your bad days are followed by 10 good days. I'm talking about that. So if you're coming from that place, you're really ready to date, and your odds of success are far greater. So then you can search for your new partner based on your values, not on trying to find the opposite of your ex or someone who will make up to you for the pain of that relationship. Then you can balance your attraction factor to someone with using your brain, because you've got to have an emotional and logical side as you date. Because you're not desperate, because you've built a good life and you're coming from a solid place, you're not going to be desperate. And so that enables you then to pay attention to what your values are and to pay attention to all the aspects of chemistry, which are physical, spiritual, and intellectual. That allows you to take time when you're dating someone new to really understand them and accept them for exactly who they are and who they are not. They are not supposed to make up to you for your past pain. They are a unique human being, and it takes time when you date someone. It's like peeling an onion. You've got to date them long enough to peel the onion and know who that is. And when you're not desperate and you have a good life, you can take the time to do that. All those things contribute to being very successful the second time around. All right, so I promised you I would talk to you a little bit about long-distance relationships today. I'm going to come back in a moment and give you some pointers about that. There are things you can do to make it more successful. There are things you can do that will make it an absolute disaster. I'm going to give you a little bit of that. So stick around. I'll be right back. Okay, welcome back. You're listening to Love Strategies. I'm Nina Atwood, your host, and I want to finish up the show today with some pointers about long-distance relationships. So because of all the internet dating sites that we're using these days, it is now far easier to connect with someone who lives a long way away from where you do. And women typically get very caught up in these long-distance relationships that sometimes drag on for a very long time in the long-distance mode, meaning emails and telephone and text messaging and Skyping. And the reason I think that women get really caught up in that and get very invested in those relationships is because we as women are wired to be very responsive and to be very emotionally reactive to verbal messages, whether they're written or spoken. We're highly tuned to verbal. And so if a guy is sending you beautiful poetry and these wonderful long emails that are highly, I guess, romantic and even seductive, and if he's spending hours talking to you on the phone and Skyping with you and he's saying all the right things, you can fall seriously in love with that. And so I get emails all the time from women who describe falling in love with a guy that they've never even met, that the only contact they have had is telephone, Skyping, text messaging, and emails. So here's the problem with that scenario. And the scenario I'm talking about is the one where the guy is very content to keep the relationship at that level. Now, I've had people email me and tell me about relationships like that that last for months and sometimes even years. One woman that I know spent a year and a half talking to a guy on the phone. They were more old school, so they didn't really text and Skype, but they did get on the phone every day and talk for hours. And then finally, a year and a half into it, she flew out to where he lived and met him, and it turned out they had no romantic chemistry. But here's what happened. The problem is, if a guy is truly content with that scenario and dragging that out for months and even years, there's one of three things happening. And one is he's really not that into you. He may enjoy the companionship. He's kind of grabbing that low-hanging fruit of having someone to talk to every day. I mean, let's face it, it can be real comforting to have someone every day that you can get on the phone with and talk to about what happened in your day and the things that you're dealing with in your life. So he's kind of grabbing that low-hanging fruit of having this telephone companion that he can speak to every day. But he's not really that into you. He doesn't feel that driver that you want in a man that says, man, I want to be with you. I want to see you. I want to touch you. I want to kiss you. I want to hold your hand. I want to be with you. I think you're my woman. You know, you want that kind of energy from a guy. And if he's not that into you, you are not going to get that kind of energy from him. And so he's not going to send you the plane ticket to fly out and see him, and he's not going to jump on the plane and come visit you. And that's a huge issue if you are falling in love with him, because now the relationship is becoming very uneven. Now it's a relationship that's working really great for him, not so much for you. But here's the second reason that you see men getting very content in this scenario and not moving it forward, and that is because he is damaged in some way. He lacks the ability to connect with a woman in the real world, to conduct a relationship in the real world, to be with you on a day-to-day basis, see you, talk to you, empty the dishwasher with you, go and pick up kids with you, to live life with you. He just doesn't know how to connect in that way. He's afraid of connecting in that way, or he just doesn't know how. He's got some kind of emotional damage or lack of bonding in the real world ability. All right, so, and that, of course, is a huge problem because that's not something you will overcome. That's not something you can somehow love him enough and be there enough for him so that one day that damage of his just melts away. It just doesn't work that way. And then the third reason is that he is hiding something. He has a secret life. He has things in his past that are extremely bad, negative. He's done something, I don't know, prison time, something in his past that he doesn't want you to know about. And if you're in his life in the real world, you're going to find that out, and he doesn't want to take that risk. So here, so those are the risks that you're facing. What can you do? What can you do to have a long-distance relationship really work? Well, I think one of the things you have to do very early on as you're talking over the phone, you live a long way apart, so you don't want to immediately jump on the plane, spend money on tickets and all that kind of stuff. So what you want to do in those conversations is really open up the question of, where is this headed? If we decide we really like each other, how long do we do this phone thing before we're going to meet in person? I would put that question right out front. And I would have some sort of a declaration of intention on both your parts that if we do this phone thing, let's say we do this for 30 days, maybe 60 days, 90 at the most, and we still like each other and we love the things that we're discovering about each other, that we're going to invest. We're going to go ahead and somebody's going to buy a plane ticket and we're going to go to the other city. But if you do that, when you do that, you always want to stay in a hotel room or have him stay in a hotel room. You do not want to go stay at his place when you're meeting him for the first time. It's extremely risky. I do not recommend it. So that is what you want to do, because what you want to do is move this relationship into the real world, because you can have tons of chemistry on the phone, but not necessarily a lot of chemistry in person. And the in-person chemistry matters, because that's how you live life together. You're not going to stay on the phone for the rest of your life with someone. That just doesn't work. So you want to move it into the real world, and the way you do that is by declaring up front how long we're going to invest in this over the phone before we are going to go ahead and take some risk and move it into the real world. Once you do that and you meet each other in person, if you have the chemistry, your next step is to discuss how long are we going to live apart, how frequently will we fly to meet one another back and forth, and what's our time frame for us to decide whether this relationship makes sense enough for one of us to move to the other person's city. I think by having those conversations up front, you really maximize your odds of success. Putting off those conversations lowers your odds of success. I'm a firm believer that the things that you say and declare are the things that you can deal with. The things that you are afraid to talk about and that you hide in the background are the things that will crater your relationship down the road. So communication is the key, as always. So thank you for being on the show with us. I just want to take a moment and acknowledge my devoted husband, Mark. Thank you for being the wind under my wing. Stay tuned for one more message, and I hope to hear you again on Love Strategies.
Thank you for joining us at Love Strategies. Be sure and visit the premier website for single men and women who want to date smart, singlescoach.com. Sign up for the newsletter and you'll get notifications for this show as well as other free dating tips. If you want a coach to support you in your growth and recovery, go to Singles Coaching on the website and choose personal coaching. That's it for today, and be sure and tune back in for more love strategies so you can date smart and find the love of your life.